Okay. Well, folks, with that, I will say what I always do, at least the variation on it anyway, and the first couple words are the same. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. It is kind of in the middle of a story, and the story is reflected in the first word of this one, where it says Pinchas, or Phinehas in some English, but Pinchas is the Hebrew term, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest. And notice how it qualifies that. The sages in the Midrash note that, because people are going to criticize, they say, oh, Pinchas, he's a murderer. And yet, the point here is, and the scriptures make it clear, he is the son of, the grandson of Aaron, the high priest, and the son of Eleazar. And of course, let's pause just for a second and say, wait a minute, we came in the middle of the story. What's essentially the story? Well, in the end of the last portion, we have all of these people that are getting whacked because they're committing idolatry, they're committing a whoring, literally. They're using the Midianite women as whores, and the fee is not in gold or silver. The fee is, got to come up and worship our gods, and you can have all the nookie you want. So Moshe is told by Yahuwah, hang them high, those that were the leadership, and then slay all of the men that have joined themselves to Baal Peor. And in the face of all of that, here comes, we're going to see their names in this portion, Zimri, son of Salu, a prince of his father's house among the Shimeonites, and the Midianite woman that he was committing boinka-boinka with was named Cozbi. She was a daughter of Zur, the head of the people of her father's house in Midian. So, obviously, there's something really sexually unclean going on with the attempt of enticing men into dealing with paganism and essentially turning away from Yah. And as a result, Zimri and Cozbi, right there in the sight of all Israel, go into the tent to do the dirty deed in front of Moshe and everybody. And what happens? Pinchas takes it upon himself, gets himself a spear, goes in, and in flagrante delicto, runs them both right through the belly. And that ends it. And 24,000 people died by the plague prior to this, but he stopped it. So, the portion begins by saying that Pinchas, that son of Eleazar, grandson of Aaron, has turned away my wrath from the B'nai Israel, in that he was very zealous. The word there is kana, and it's an interesting word. And it can mean jealous or zealous, but in this case, he was very zealous to do the right thing for my sake, he says. And of course, these are, they should be the words in red, if your Bible does that, among them. So that, in fact, I did not consume the children of Israel in my own jealousy. Because he's a zealous God, jealous, and doesn't like to have pagans usurping his glory. So, therefore, say, behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace. So this is the my covenant of shalom. And interestingly, this is one of the also places where I guess it's worthy to point out, because you don't see this in English at all. In the Hebrew, shalom is spelled with a vav. Okay, that's the O sound, shalom, so there's your vav. But in the scribal notations, it's broken. It's a broken nail, broken vav. So vav has a kind of a semblance of a nail. It's interesting. What do you suspect that means? Broken peace, it's a covenant of peace. In any case, there's always some significance. And so when we see these things, it's certainly worth pointing out, thinking about, praying about. But it gives us a little bit of additional insight, I think, because otherwise this is such an enigmatic story. What is it that you will hear the standard treatment? Oh, well, Pinchas, this guy's a really nasty dude. All this fellow was doing was just, committing a little bit of idolatry in front of all of the house of Israel. What's the big deal here? Pinchas committed murder. Isn't that we should let him off the hook. I mean, you're not going to kill somebody just for a little of that. And the answer is the creator of the universe seemed to think otherwise. And his covenant of peace includes this broken vav in the word shalom to emphasize something. Now, again, they claim there's a moral quandary here. I'm going to say there's not. Because anytime you have the Creator coming out and making sure that we understand this guy's lineage, Jethro is in his line, Yitro, related at least by marriage to Moshe. So they're going to say, well, he's a pagan. And he was even a priest of Midian, if you recall. But this covenant of peace is not only going to go to him and to his seed after him, it's the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. He's already a Kohen, because he was zealous for his Elohim, and he made atonement for the B'nai Yisrael. The moral, and I saw as I was looking through the various Midrashim and some of the commentaries on this, there's all kinds of stuff, and this is where I part with a lot of rabbinic Judaism. They'll say, the Halacha says this, and the Halacha says that Pinchas was just plain guilty on every front. He committed multiple crimes here. How could he possibly do that? So they have a dilemma at hand. How do you justify not following the rules of the rabbis? Maybe that's part of the broken shalom. But in any case, there's a message there. It's a similar message, if you think about it, to the one Yeshua gives. He didn't think too much of the halacha, the traditions of the elders. And I think probably he would have been right there, because he is, in fact, one with the Creator, as far as saying, yeah, Pinchas deserves the covenant of peace. What I'm going to suggest is, it's not murder if the Creator of the universe tells you after the fact that it's not. But the question for the rest of us is, how do we know in advance, right? Because if you try to formulate rules and say it's got to be this, or one life always supersedes the other thing, if it saves just one life, it's worth doing. I actually saw a piece that I didn't care for, and this is kind of encroaching on what I'll talk about tomorrow. But from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, the late head rabbi of Britain, where he was saying, there are so many moral dilemmas, and Pinchas, maybe this is a political decision as opposed to a moral one and so forth. After all, he compares it to COVID, where there was a moral decision that was made, and the governments of the world were united on making this moral decision about saving lives. Pardon my bluntness. Bullshit. What a crock. It was about genocide. It was about a bioweapon. There was no moral decision to save lives. It was an immoral decision to end them. Oh, and 24,000 that died by the plague? Come to think of it, folks, that's small potatoes compared to the number that those who are immoral killed in the process of doing something. So I do think there's a parallel here, but it just ain't having to do with the things that people would say. So I guess what I'm contending is, if we actually do understand the Creator's motivation and walk in agreement with that, we're way ahead of those that are trying to put a formula on here and say, look, when it comes to saving lives, the governments of the world were right to mandate that people take a poison injection. Oh, yeah. When you come to a conclusion like that, there's something horribly, cataclysmically, satanically flawed in your logic. So he gets the covenant of peace because he was zealous for his Elohim. He made atonement for the B'nai Israel. Yeah, and he killed Zimri and Cozbi in the process. Okay, it tells us the name. The name of the man was who was slain for boinking the Midianitish woman was Zimri, son of Salu. He was a prince of his father's house among the people of Simeon. And the Midianitish woman, she was Cozbi, like we've already said. And Yahuwah then spoke to Moshe, and he said, this is an interesting term too, because it's an interesting word here, vex, harass, Zaror, the Midianites, and smite them. Now, in Leviticus 18, it talks about if a man takes, while his first wife is living, if he takes her sister as a wife, to harass her, to vex her, to zaror her. Same word. It's just the other time that it's used. And so there's something very serious here, because in the case of what Moses is told to do, it's harass them. It's going to involve a lot of them dying. Why? Because they harass you, he says, same word, by their wiles, their feminine wiles, whereby they have beguiled you in the matter of Peor, in the matter of Cozbi, a daughter of the prince of Midian, their sister, who was slain on the day of the plague in the matter of Peor. So it came to pass after that, the next chapter says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and to Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, and he said, count the heads, take the sum, lift up the head, right? There's that same word, Sa'u et Rosh. Of all the congregation of the B'nai Israel, up to from 20 years old and upwards, by their father's houses, all that are able to go to war. This is the same essential commandment that was given at the beginning of the book of Numbers. Remember the answer there? We get the listing of all the houses. Turns out the number was 603,550 men able to go to war. Well, what do we know? These are different men. And Moshe and Eleazar the priest did. They spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, and they said, take the sum of the people, 20 years old and up, count the heads, lift them up, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe, those that came forth out of Egypt, just like we did before. Reuben, firstborn of Israel, the sons. And I won't read all of these. What I'll do is kind of summarize the numbers. Suffice it to say, we've seen the formula. We're going to get the name of the tribe, and then the main elders, the sons of the person for whom the tribe is named, like Reuben's sons, and they are Hanok and Palu and Hezron and Carmi. In each case, it says the family of the Hanokites, Palu, family of the Paluites, and so forth. So the names of those tribes are also, they carry their father's name, and they're part of Reuben. These are the families of the Reubenites. They that were numbered of them, 43,730. Now, I won't do it here, but in the past, I've gone through, and you can certainly compare. See, which tribes got bigger, which tribes got smaller, and in general, there is a more or less consistency, but there are some notable exceptions. So those are the ones that I'll note as we go through here. All right. Then the sons of Palu are named Eliab, Nemuel, Dathan, and Abiram. These, the same Dathan and Abiram, oh, we remember that name, the elect of the congregation, those were the ones who strove with Moshe and Aaron against them, along with Korah, when they strove against Yahuwah, notice how it's phrased, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah, and that whole company died. The fire devoured 250 men. So we're going to get a recap of the revolution, the rebellion of Korah. Notwithstanding, there were sons of Korah who died not, so all of them didn't die. Then we go to Simeon, after their families. Nemuel, Yamin, Zerah, Shaul. These are the families of the Simeonites. 22,200. Simeon, 22,200. Now, this one is interesting, because I made a note in my margin here. Remember what it was? Well, maybe you don't, but if you look back and see what it was, Simeon, back after the first head count, was 59,300. Now, we're not told why, but Simeon has down over 30,000 men, and that's over half in those 40 years in the wilderness. Something's going on there, right? Sons of Gad, after their families, Zephon, Haggai, Shunai, Ozni, and Eri, and Arad. These are the families of Gad. They're numbered 40,500. Sons of Judah, we know the names, Ur and Onan, and of course they died in the land of Canaan. And then after that, you have Shelah, Perez, Zerah, and gives the sons of Perez, Hezron, and Hamul. These are the families of Judah. Those that were numbered, 76,500. So Judah has remained a huge house. Sons of Issachar, Tola, Puva, Jashub, Shimron. And when you number them, you got 64,300. Sons of Zebulun, Sered, and Elon. Elon, that's an interesting name. These are the families of the Zebulunites, those that were numbered there, 60,500. Then we have the sons of Joseph. Of course, they're divided into two parts that were both grafted in, Manasseh and Ephraim. First, Manasseh, Machir, he begot Gilead, Gileadites. Then he had sons, Yetzer, Helek, and Azriel, and Shechem, and Shemida, Hefer, Zelophehad. Now this is where we're going to get a little bit of a variation, and we're going to see more of this story in this same Torah portion. Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, he did not have any sons. He only had daughters. The names of the daughters, we're going to come back to this again, were Malha, Noha, Hugla, Milka, and Tirzah. So it sets up here the note that we're going to see at the end of this portion. These are the families of Manasseh. They were numbered 52,700. Next, Ephraim and their families. Shutela, Becher, Tahan, and the sons of Shutela, Aaron. These are the numbered of Ephraim, according to those that were numbered to them, 32,500. So smaller than Manasseh. These are the families of Joseph after their families. Now, you add those together, and you've got a little over 85,000. So it's combined the biggest of the houses. Sons of Benjamin, Bela, Ashbel, Ahiram, Shephufam, Hufam, and the sons of Bela were Ard and Naaman. And Ard had some sons, too. These are the sons of Benjamin after their families. They that were numbered of them, 45,600. Then we get to Dan, and he had sons, Shuham, and all of those that were numbered of Dan, 64,400. Asher, Imnah, Ishvi, Beriah, and he had sons, Heber, and Malkiel. And the name of the daughter of Asher was Sarah. Now, this is not the same Sarah, and it's actually spelled slightly differently in the Hebrew. That doesn't necessarily mean it's just a difference in the vowel pointer. But notice, we don't very often hear about the daughters. And as I'm looking at the name, now I didn't check this and see, but I suspect that that's important. Obviously, she wouldn't have been named otherwise. I'm looking around the room. Nobody else recognizes the name either. It's not, it doesn't leap off the page at us, right? But it is unusual. So it's certainly worth pointing out whenever we see something that breaks that pattern. These are the families of Asher. They that were numbered, 53,400. Naphtali, you got Jaziel, Guni, Jezer, or Yezer, and the and Shilem. When you add them up, you have 45,400. So, put them all together. Verse 51 says, they that were numbered, or the head count, of the Bnei Israel, 601,730. So, 603,550. So we've lost almost 2,000 men of fighting age over a period of 40 years. By and large, the tribes have stayed more or less the same size. I mean, that's only a less than 1% difference, far less than 1% difference. But still, they didn't grow during this time in the wilderness. And some of the tribes took a big hit, as we saw. Yehudah then spoke to Moshe, and he said, unto these shall the land be divided for an inheritance according to the number of the names. So, why is this important and interesting? Well, of course, it is the book of Numbers in English, and you see that, yeah, once more, we've got lots of numbers. But remember, the size of the tribes is going to affect when they draw the lots, which determines where they are, how big of the parcels each of these families or tribes are going to get. So the biggest one's going to get more land. To the more you shall give, the more inheritance. To the fewer you shall give less inheritance. To each one, according to those that were numbered of it, shall the inheritance be given. So at this point, what really matters in terms of kind of the long-term perspective is, if you look at the maps, we're going to see that the biggest portions were given to the biggest tribes. Notwithstanding, the land shall be divided by lot. And according to the names, they shall inherit. Turning to the lot, their inheritance will be divided between the more and the fewer. So that's going to apply, it would look like, to the sons of the sons, too. These are they that were numbered of the Levites after their families. So, now back to the Levites. You got Gershon and Kohath, Merari. These are the families of Levi, the Libnites, the Hebronites, the Mahlites, the Mushites, the Korahites. And, of course, and Kohath begot Amram. The name of Amram's wife, Jochebed, the daughter of Levi, born to Levi in Egypt, and we know who was born to them, right? She bore unto Amram Aaron and Moshe, along with Miriam, their sister. And unto Aaron were born Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. We know what happened to Nadab and Abihu. They died after they offered strange fire before Yahuwah. They that were numbered of them, 23,000. Every male from a month old and upward, remember, they're not numbered the same way because they don't go to battle. There was no inheritance given to them among the Bnei Israel either. Those that were numbered by Moshe and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the children of Israel at the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. But among these, it says, not a man that were numbered the first time by Moshe and Aaron back in the wilderness of Sinai, because Yahuwah told them then, you will surely die in the wilderness. So there was not a single man left among them, 603,550, except for Caleb, son of Jephunneh, Joshua, son of Nun. They drew near. Then drew near the daughters of Zelophehad, the ones we were just talking about, son of Hefer, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, of the family of Manasseh. And he was, of course, the son of Joseph. Here are their names. Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moshe and before Eleazar and all the princes and at the door of the tent of meeting, and they said, look, our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company that gathered themselves against Yahuwah with Korah, so he wasn't part of the rebellion, but he died in his own sin, not denying that. He had no sons. So why should the name of our father be done away with from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession too, they ask, among the brethren of our father. So, Moshe brought their cause before Yahuwah, and Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and here's what he said. The daughters of Zelophehad speak rightly. Surely you'll give them a possession of an inheritance among their father's brethren, and cause that inheritance of their father to pass to them. And you speak to the Bnei Israel, and you say the following. If a man dies, and he doesn't have any son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. If he doesn't have a daughter, then you give his inheritance to his brethren. If he has no brethren, then give his inheritance to his father's brethren. Okay, to his uncles. If his father doesn't have any brethren, then you give the inheritance into his kinsman that is next to him of his family. So basically, we're talking about a line of inheritance to relatives that are further out on the tree. And that one shall possess it. And it shall be unto the Bnei Israel a statute, that's a huch, of judgment, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. So it's a huchat mishpat. Yahuwah said then to Moshe, get yourself up to this mountain of Abarim, and behold the land which I've given to the Bnei Israel. When you've seen it, you'll be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother was gathered, because you rebelled against my commandment in the wilderness of Zin, in the strife of the congregation, and failed to sanctify me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribath Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. So, at this point, Moshe speaks to Yahuwah, and he says, let Yahuwah, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation. In other words, who's going to succeed me? Set a man over the congregation who may go out before them, come in before them, who may lead them out, and who may bring them in, that the congregation of Yahuwah be not as sheep which have no shepherd. Now, we don't see it here. Rashi, as one of the sages, claims that he seems to be arguing that for his sons, that perhaps Gershon should be the one to lead. And, of course, that's not going to be the answer. Yahuwah then says to Moshe, okay, you take Joshua, son of Nun. And, of course, the man in whom is spirit. Notice the present tense. He already has this spirit. We've already been told that 40 years ago. And lay your hand upon him, set him before Eleazar the priest, before all the congregation, and give him a charge in their sight. You shall put of your honor upon him, and Kol Ha'edah of the Bnei Israel may hearken. He's going to be anointed, if you will. Put your honor, in other words, upon him. And all of the congregation of Israel is going to see that and hearken. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who will inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before Yahuwah. So remember the Urim Vetumim. This is the way that they get an understanding of what Yah's will is. At his word they shall go out, at his word they'll come in, both he and the Bnei Israel with him, even all of the congregation. Vekol Ha'edah. So Moshe did as Yahuwah commanded. He took Joshua, set him before Eleazar the Kohen, and all of the congregation, laid hands on him, gave him the charge, as Yahuwah spoke by the hand of Moshe. So now we have Joshua being in position to succeed. Yahuwah then spoke to Moshe, and he said, command the Bnei Israel, say to them, my food, which is presented unto me for offerings made by fire of a sweet savor unto me, you shall observe to offer unto me in its due season. You'll say to them, this is the offering made by fire you'll bring to Yahuwah. He lambs of the first year without blemish. Two day by day. So every day we're going to have two he lambs. A morning and an evening lamb for a continual burnt offering. One in the morning, one in the evening, or one at dusk. Along with 1/10 part of an ephah of fine flour for meal offering, mingled with 1/4 part of a hin of beaten oil. It is a continual burnt offering, which was offered in Mount Sinai for a sweet savor, an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. The drink offering thereof, 1/4 part of a hin for one lamb, in a holy place you pour out a drink offering of strong drink unto Yahuwah. The other lamb you make it present at dusk, as a meal offering of the morning, and as the drink offering thereof you shall present it. It's an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. Now, as we go through the rest of these, you're going to see that there are other offerings made for different times of celebration, set apart holy days, Moedim. But one of the things that's going to be made continually clear is it's always in addition to the ones that already apply. In other words, you're going to offer all these other lambs on special occasions, or other goats or bulls on special occasions, but whatever it is, morning and the evening lamb, that still happens. The Sabbath day, for example, two he-lambs of the first year without blemish, 2/10 part of an ephah of fine flour for meal offering, mingled with oil, drink offering. This is the burnt offering for every Sabbath, besides the continuing burnt offering and the drink offering. So these offerings are additional too. On your new moons, okay, the Rosh Kodesh, you shall present a burnt offering to Yahuwah, 2 young bullocks and 1 ram, 7 he lambs of the first year without blemish, and now 3/10 part of an ephah of flour, fine flour for meal offering, mingled with oil for each bull, 2/10 fine flour, meal offering, mingled with oil for 1 ram, and 10/7 part of fine flour mingled with oil for a meal offering for every lamb, burnt offering for a sweet savor, an offering made by fire to Yahuwah. These drink offerings shall be 1/2 hin of wine for a bull, 1/3 of a hin for a ram, 1/4 for a lamb. This is the burnt offering of every Rosh Kodesh throughout the months of the year. And one he-goat for sin offering unto Yahuwah, it'll be offered beside the continuing burnt offerings and the drink offerings. And in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, now we're going to come to the special times. That one would be the Passover, Pesach, of Yahuwah. On the 15th day of this month, there's a feast. 7 days, unleavened bread. First day is to be a holy convocation. You shall do no manner of servile work. Notice, now let's pause here. This is not the first, not the second. How many times throughout Scripture, over and over again, he repeats, these are my feasts, these are my Sabbaths, this is my set-apart time, my moed, or my moedim in this case, you shall do these things. He never changed them. He didn't do away with them. Now, the things that you can do, the things that he's going to require here, well, if the place to do this is gone, you can't very well do it. He took that away. But he never says that we're not to at least remember those days. And also, the commandments associated with them are the same. First day, it's a holy convocation. You do no manner of servile work. You do make that offering unto Yahuwah by fire, an olah to Yahuwah. 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 he lambs of the first year, they shall be to you without blemish. And their meal offering, fine flour mingled with oil, 3/10 part, you shall offer of oil for a bull, 2/10 for the ram, 10/7 part for every lamb of those 7. 1 he-goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. These you shall offer in addition to the burnt offering of the morning. That's a continual burnt offering. And in this manner you shall offer daily for 7 days the food of the offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah, in addition to the continual burnt offering and the drink offering. On the 7th day, right, again, a holy convocation, same commandment, you shall do no manner of servile work. Also, in the day of first fruits, so this is the final of the spring feasts, you bring a new meal offering to Yahuwah in your feast of weeks. You'll have a holy convocation, do no manner of servile work, and you shall present a burnt offering for a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 he lambs of the first year. So this pattern seems consistent. Along with their meal offering, fine flour with oil, 3/10 part for each bull, 2/10 for a ram, 10/10 parts for each of the 7 lambs, and 1 he-goat to make atonement for you. This is besides the continual burnt offering and a meal offering that you offer them. They shall be to you without blemish, along with your drink offerings. We're going to continue, because guess what? We now have the fall feast. In the 7th month, on the 1st day of the month, say, so this is generally at the new moon, you shall do a holy, you shall have a holy convocation. On that one, you shall do no manner of servile work. It is a day of blowing the shofar unto you. And you shall prepare a burnt offering for a sweet savor to Yahuwah, 1 young bull, 1 ram, 7 he lambs of the first year without blemish, their meal offering, fine for arming with oil, 3/10 part for the bull, 2/10 for the ram, 1/10 for every lamb of the 7, 1 he-goat for a chatat to make an offering, atonement for you. And this is besides the burnt offering of the new moon, because, right, this falls on the new moon, and the meal offering thereof, and the continual burnt offering, and the meal offering thereof, and their drink offerings, according to the ordinance. Now, I just realized, we gloss over this, but it says besides the burnt offering on the new moon. So for those that want to argue about calendars, I can't help but think, while this is not what I would call definitive, it certainly is an indication that this first day of the month would be an offering for the new moon. And that's the day of the Yom Teruah, the blowing of the shofar. Do no manner of work on it. You present a burnt offering to Yahuwah for a sweet savor, one young bull, one ram, seven he lambs of the first year. They're without blemish, along with their meal offerings, fine flour mingled with oil, 3/10 for the bull, 2/10 for the ram, a several tenth part for every of the seven lambs, one he-goat for a chatat. That's in addition to the sin offering for atonement and the continual burnt offerings and the meal offerings and the drink offerings. All of these things are additive. When we get to the holy days, you're going to have all the regular stuff plus. And when you get to this time of the moed, the only one that falls on the new moon, we get all of them. On the 15th day of the month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no manner of servile work, and you shall keep a feast unto Yahuwah for 7 days. Now, you notice what's missing? In this list, we do not see Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Because what we're talking about here are offerings. And this is a different, I guess you could say, a different milieu of offerings. And there's a certain barbecue element that clearly kind of rings through in this last one. 15th day of the month, you have a holy convocation, no manner of servile work. It's a feast unto Yahuwah for 7 days. And this one's going to be quite interesting and kind of involved. We're going to get lots of text on this. You shall present a burnt offering, an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah, 13 young bullocks, 2 rams, 14 he-lambs of the first year without blemish, along with their meal offerings, fine flour mingled with oil, 3/10 for each bull, 2/10 for each ram of the 2 rams, and a several tenth part for each lamb of the 14 lambs. This is a big barbecue. 1 he-goat for a sin offering, in addition to the continual burnt offering, the meal offering, the drink offering. So, again, all additive. Remember, this is a 7-day feast. On the second day, you present 12 young bullocks, 2 rams, 14 he-lambs of the first year without blemish, and their meal offerings, drink offerings for the rams, the lambs, and the bulls, according to their number after the ordinance. 1 he-goat for a sin offering, that's in addition to the continual burnt offering, meal offering, and the drink offerings. All right, when we get to the third day, we're going to start to see the pattern pretty clearly, because it's going to go through each of the days, and the wording is almost identical. I always find that interesting, as you know. Whenever you see, because we know there's no idle word in Torah, and yet there's a lot of redundancy here. Why? I can think of some obvious reasons as an engineer, but I can't help but think there's probably a lot more to it than even that. One, for example, is whenever you see redundancy in text, you say, well, what that does, if we see the pattern especially, it gives us a great degree of confidence in the proper rendering of the text. In other words, did the scribes get it right? And the answer is we can actually compare it. We can compare one section to the next, and we can see that's just part of it. Again, there's more. And how much more? I don't even think we know all of it. We can just think of different reasons why, and we're probably, still not getting them all. But we get to the third day. Now notice, this time it's 11 bulls. It was 12. On that first day, what was it? 13 young bulls. 2 rams, well, that's the same. 14 he-lambs of the first year without blemish. Well, that's the same. So one thing we can see at this point is, if you look at what's going on, the number of bulls or bullocks is counting down with each day. So what I'll do is I'll kind of go through the next few, because we see the pattern, and then we'll see if it's consistent. And it turns out that it is. The fourth day, 10 bulls, 2 rams, 14 he-lambs. And the meal offering, drink offerings, the same numbers there. And the he-goat for a sin offering, in addition to all the other regular daily offerings. Fifth day, 9 bulls, 2 rams, 14 he-lambs, meal offerings, drink offerings, and so forth. Sixth day, 8 bulls, 2 rams, 14 he-lambs. Seventh day, this is the seventh day of seven. We're going to get 7 bulls, 2 rams, 14 he-lambs of the first year without blemish. So I years ago, I remember going through here and saying, what do we see here? If you add up the number of the day plus the number of bulls, in other words, on the first day, you got 13 bulls. Seventh day, you got 7 bulls. Well, the number of days plus the number of the bulls always equals 14. And the number of he-lambs? Always 14. 2 weeks, 2 times 7. Is there something there? I'm sure there is. But am I going to tell you that I know what it is? No, just so we can see the pattern. The meal offerings, drink offerings, the he-lambs, and of course the 1 he-goat for sin offering, besides the others, the continual burnt offering, meal offering, drink offerings. On the eighth day, you shall have a solemn assembly. You shall do no manner of servile work. So you got 7 days, then plus the eighth day in this case. But no manner of servile work. This is a, remember, that was the first day and the last day. But now this time you're to present a burnt offering, an offering made by fire, sweet savor to Yahuwah, one bull, one ram, seven he lambs of the first year without blemish. So the pattern has changed on the eighth day. Their meal offering, their drink offering for the bull, for the ram, the he lambs, according to their number after the ordinance, and one he goat for sin offering, besides the continual burnt offering, meal offering, and the drink offering. These you shall offer unto Yahuwah in your appointed seasons. And this, it says, is besides your vows and your free will offerings, whether they be for your burnt offerings or your meal offerings or your drink offerings or your peace offerings. So we're almost to the end of the portion. Technically, it ends with verse 1 of chapter 30, and as you might suspect, oftentimes there's a difference between the Hebrew Bibles and the English Bibles in terms of the verse and chapter numberings. But we're going to see that in the English Bibles, at least, Pinchas ends not at the end of the chapter, but in the last verse of the next chapter. And the next chapter, of course, we're going to get a major change of pace, but it says this: Moshe told the B'nai Israel according to all that Yahuwah commanded Moshe. All right, so with that, that is, again, the end of the Torah portion and the end of the story of Pinchas and a whole lot of things that would seem repetitious, but I can't help but know one more time. Isn't it funny that Yod-Heh-Vah-Heh spends so much ink on things that the whole church says don't matter, they're old, they're done away with, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. And I can't help but think, how wrong can you be? How many times does he have to tell us something in Scripture before certain of the whore church will say, huh, just maybe, since he said he wasn't changing one yod or tittle of it, and there's lots and lots of text in here, that just maybe he was telling the truth. Must make him angry when he gets called a liar and by the whore church, when in fact he never changed any of this stuff. At least he didn't change it in a way that they will tell you, so as to pay no attention to it. He did take certain things away, like the temple, because of the rebellion of those who were not paying attention. Kind of wonder, you think there's a pattern that's going to be repeated at some point? I suspect we'll see it. I hope we'll see it. I hope and pray that we will see some of the things that we know are coming begin to play out. Already some of them are, but there's a lot more to come. From the screen, there's a comment. And this comment is always one that we talk about, and I could spend a lot of time. Probably I'll try to refrain a little bit from doing that. So many Christians say they don't have to obey because they're not Jews, which makes no sense. And of course, most Jews, most Christians don't seem to know the meaning of those words. Okay, what does a Jew mean today? Well, it means somebody who has a certain bloodline. But does it mean that they're descendants of Judah? Not necessarily. There are those who say they are not, right? Say they're Jews, but they're not, says Yeshua. The bloodlines may or may not be the issue. I've certainly known many, many Jews that were not observant, religious, Torah observant types, or even halakha, rabbinic observant types. So the point is, a lot of these words don't mean what people think they mean. The truth of the matter is that it's Israel, and it's not a political nation of Israel, but Israel was the mixed multitude that was grafted in, and of course that's what Paul talks about, as being grafted in. But remember, there were, depending upon how you count, 13 tribes, or even 14, that sometimes they counted those that went to war, sometimes they included the Levites and so forth, Ephraim and Manasseh, or maybe it was just Joseph. The number comes out to be 12, because the Bible counts them according to the message that's being delivered at the time. But all of those, they're not Jews. Only one of those tribes is rightfully called Jews, and that would be Judah. There are those that would be religious rabbinic types, and they may or may not even overlap with the various tribes. There are those that are called Christians that don't really even know that they are also part of the 12 tribes. They don't even know their own lineage or history. So we need to be more careful, I guess, is the message with some of these labels, especially when people make all kinds of declarations and claims that are absolutely flatulent. There's a great word to put it when it comes to Scripture as written.